I can't tell you how many emails or phone calls that I got saying there's a mistake on the agenda. It says Book of Mormon Tories. I know it's supposed to be Book of Mormon Stories, and I said, no, it's not, and you're soon to find out why. But I got to give you a couple of little announcements. It's been pointed out to me that, believe it or not, we made a mistake on the program. We originally had the 1 o'clock session scheduled for 1:30 and had lunch from 11:30 to 1:30. When we changed the time, we forgot to change the lunch time. So lunch is just an hour and a half from 11:30 to 1, and we will be starting at 1 o'clock with Ken Clark's presentation. So make sure that you're back by 1 o'clock because you're not going to want to miss it. And someone has brought a collection that they've gotten over the years of a lot of publications from the Tanners, and he's donating them. They're up here on the table for you to take with the hope that you'll give some sort of a donation to the foundation, and there's an envelope for that up here, so you might want to take a look at some of those. And then thirdly, we have got several dinners that are going to be available for those who've asked about them. The hotel was able to bounce our count up at the last minute for us. So if you're interested in purchasing for a dinner tonight, be sure and contact Lou, and he'll be able to accommodate that for you. And so we would love to have you if you want to do that, and they are available. Without further ado, I'm going to turn the time over to Tom.
Thank you, sir. I bring you greetings from the Arizona delegation, most of which have shown up here today, amazingly. I also need to take some time to thank some people. I don't know if you know who...
That was not my fault.
Okay. The geeks are in control. I'm not. If you know who Ted Chandler is of MormonStudies.com, he hosts some of my web pages for free, as does Jeff Ricks of PostMormon.org. I'm very grateful to those guys. People that have encouraged me and linked me, people like Richard Packham, Dale Broadhurst, Steve Clark of the Lampoon, the Utah Lighthouse Ministry, Mormon Curtain, it goes on. Even Concerned Christians in Mesa, I'm not affiliated with them, but they allowed me to give this presentation there at one time, and it was well received.
Can you hear?
No.
Can this be?
Maybe the master's not on. Where's Darren?
Okay.
Like a rock star.
It's a pretty girl. Get close.
Have you forgotten?
It's coming back to me. And of course, Sue and Lou and everybody in the foundation. Now, I don't even know where to begin with all this, where this began with me, but of course it began with my leaving the church and the reasons I left, but I also knew there was always questions I had that I never had the courage to really follow through on until I got that courage, and then I could ask myself those questions I've been evading. And as far as Book of Mormon origins are concerned, we all know it's pretty true that if Joseph Smith was the author, and we don't even know if that's true sometimes, that he borrowed from the Bible. And there's plenty of good work out there demonstrating borrowings from the Bible. And even paraphrased borrowings, which there's a subtlety there I'd like to get into a little later. But as far as the war and the political material, where did that come from? I always knew from my American history that the Tories of the American Revolution had a similarity to the Kingmen in the Book of Mormon. And there was also all these republicanisms in the Book of Mormon. There's phrases like a free government and other ones like that. And I got real suspicious, and I thought, I'm going to look in these areas. Joseph Smith himself was partial to the Methodists, he said at one point, but he also borrows from, in the history of the church, he talks about the Founding Fathers, and he quotes the Founding Fathers. So I thought, well, here's another clue, maybe, and if this thing is going to work, yes. This is one of my favorite quotes of Joseph Smith. If mobs come upon you anymore here, dung your gardens with them. We don't want any excitement, but after all we have done, we will rise up, Washington-like, and break off the hellish yoke that oppresses us, and we will not be mobbed. Well, and we know too that Washington was a mason. Now, that has really nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about, but I thought for our concerns here, this would be a fun slide to have. He's got his little Masonic, apron there with the square and compass and all that stuff. But anyway, Joseph Smith had his dreams of being a big general himself, and he wanted to run for president. So you take all this into account and think, okay, you got all this Book of Mormon verbiage going on, and he's got all this stuff in his background, so what does this all mean? Well, I have this letter from General George Washington, the Canadians, and I have some help here. Now, they're passing that out. Go ahead. Yeah, it's the long one. For those of you that are interested, take these home with you. But how I got here, we'll start with this. I took that assumption. Let's say Joseph Smith's the author. There's theories that maybe he isn't, but let's say he is. And he's got all this stuff going on with the Founding Fathers. Who does he appreciate? Who does he want to be like? Are these great men? So I started reading anything I could get my hands on dealing with these Founding Fathers, their writings. I sent away for books. I ended up picking up this one. It's called George Washington, A Collection. Very nice book. Very thick book. I've read lots of thick books in the process of doing this. As I started reading through it, I got little hits here and there, little verbiages, little fun things, but nothing you could really write to Gordon B. Hinckley about and ask him questions over. But then I came across what's called the Canada Letter that we're handing out right now. And as we go through this, I want you to, for those of you who are Book of Mormon experts, things may jump out at you. If you're not familiar with the Book of Mormon, it may go right over. But he starts out saying, "Friends and brethren, the unnatural contest between the English colonies and Great Britain has now risen to such a height that arms alone must decide it." You know, Washington's trying to incorporate the Canadians on the side of the Americans. This letter was carried by Benedict Arnold in 1775 in leaflet form to Canada, Quebec. "The colonies, confiding in the justice of their cause and the purity of their intentions, have reluctantly appealed to that being in whose hands are all human events. He has hitherto smiled upon their virtuous efforts. The hand of tyranny has been arrested in its ravages, and the British arms, which have shone with so much splendor in every part of the globe, are now tarnished with disgrace and disappointment. Generals of approved experience who boasted of subduing this great continent find themselves circumscribed within the limits of a single city and its suburbs, suffering all the shame and distress of a siege. While the freeborn sons of America, animated by the genuine principles of liberty and love of their country, with increasing union, firmness, and discipline, repel every attack and despise every danger. Above all, we rejoice that our enemies have been deceived with regard to you. They have persuaded themselves, they have even dared to say that the Canadians were not capable of distinguishing between the blessings of liberty and the wretchedness of slavery, that gratifying the vanity of a little circle of nobility would blind the eyes of the people of Canada. By such artifices they hoped to bend you to their views, but they have been deceived. Instead of finding in you that poverty of soul and baseness of spirit, they see with a chagrin equal to our joy that you are enlightened, generous, and virtuous, that you will not renounce your rights or serve as instruments to deprive your fellow subjects of theirs. Come then, my brother, unite with us in an indissoluble union. Let us run together to the same goal. We have taken up arms in defense of our liberty, our property, our wives, and our children. We are determined to preserve them or die." I heard some gasps out there. "We look forward with pleasure to that day, not far remote, we hope, when the inhabitants of America shall have one sentiment and the full enjoyment of the blessings of a free government. Incited by these motives and encouraged by the advice of many friends of liberty among you, the great American Congress has sent an army into your province under the command of General Schuyler, not to plunder, but to protect you, to animate and bring forth into action those sentiments of freedom you have declared, which the tools of despotism would extinguish through the whole creation. To cooperate with this design and to frustrate those cruel and perfidious schemes which would deluge our frontier with the blood of women and children, I have detached Colonel Arnold into your country with a part of the army under my command. I have enjoined upon him and am certain that he will consider himself and act as in the country of his patrons and best friends. Necessaries and accommodations of every kind which you may furnish, he will thankfully receive. and render the full value. I invite you as friends and brethren to provide him with such supplies as your country affords. And I pledge myself not only for your safety and security, but for ample compensation. Let no man desert his habitation. Let no man flee as before an enemy. The cause of America and of liberty is the cause of every virtuous American citizen, whatever may be his religion or his descent. The United Colonies know no distinction but such as slavery, corruption, and arbitrary domination may create. Come then, ye generous citizens, range yourselves under the standard of general liberty, against which all the force and artifice of tyranny will never be able to prevail. I am, so forth, so forth. That's how he actually ends that, with the et cetera. Now, for you Book of Mormon experts out there, did you notice something? Okay, now, if you wouldn't mind, my lovely Arizona delegation, please hand out the comparison sheets. I'm going to go to that. So I broke it down. I recognized lots of things in that letter, and I thought, holy mackerel, there's something going on here. So as you can see, terms like friends and brethren is already in the Book of Mormon. Blessings of liberty, pretty common stuff, but at the same time, why is it this most correct book full of things Washington had already said in 1775? Blessings of liberty is pretty common, but when we move along, this is the big one. Where we have taken up arms in defense of our liberty, our property, our wives, our children, they have taken up arms in defense of their wives, land, children, and Alma 48:10, their liberty, their lands, their wives, and their children. Now, you remember when you were in school and you had to do a report and you got the encyclopedia out and you changed a few words and nobody will know I borrowed from the encyclopedia. Well, the next logical question I had to ask is, and of course there was standard of liberty too in here. We saw standard of general liberty, and the Book of Mormon has standard of liberty. But I'm thinking while I'm reading this, what is the likelihood that Joseph Smith would have had a copy of this pamphlet that was handed out by General Arnold in 1775 in Quebec, and not a very good one? Could it be that Washington was quoting from somebody else, that this isn't original to Washington? Is this all common verbiage? You know, I had to figure all this stuff out. I thought probably the most likely thing is this is reproduced in histories of the American Revolution, and that would be more likely source where he would have got it from. Determined to preserve them or die. They were determined to conquer in this place or die. A free government, standard of general liberty, standard of liberty. If you notice, too, there's a lot in Alma going on, a lot in the same verse, same chapters. So now I got a new problem. I'm thinking, if I come right out and say, Joseph Smith copied from this letter, I could expose myself as an amateur, because if that's not the case, then I would, lose my argument. So I start resourcing and thinking, okay, where would this be? Where would this letter be? So let me mention one other thing before I go on there. The Bible is often quoted by the Founding Fathers, and you find that's a common source for lots of stuff is the Bible. And I also was reading a lot of printed sermons. There was a fellow named Peter Thatcher in 1793 in a sermon called A Sermon Preached Before the Ancient and Honorable Artillery Company. He uses the phrase, they fight for their wives, their children, their liberty, and their all. You can interpret that as their property. And he also says, we will determine to conquer or die. He was part of the Revolutionary War, and he was reminding these later peoples that they still need to fight for these things. I'm thinking, well, he's a preacher, and I had the info-based disc, if any of you know who that is, what that is. And I'm trying to find if there's a common Bible source here, where would it be and how could I find it? So I have to try all different word combinations. He told the people, we're not there to take you over, we're just there to help you. And we're there to help you rally around this standard of general liberty. Now, liberty poles were something that was very important to the colonists. The British would hack them down and the colonists would throw them back up, and they were called liberty poles. Now, if you remember our buddy Moroni, I brought the Moroni action figure. And he doesn't do much. He just stands there with his squiggly wording all over his coat. And somebody needs to tell Brother Packer he has a skirt on. And this is before the Industrial Revolution. There is no little factory here either. Now, remember, he makes his liberty, title liberty, he causes it to be erected in all the land, goes around the land with these titles of liberty. And Washington had he had roving headquarters because he had to stay on the move. One of them was called the Liberty Hall Tavern. And it just gets to the point where, you know, where does randomness go away and where does this become intentional? Just more, lots more verbiage. Even things like drinking blood. He's referring to the British would try to get the American Indians on their side, and they would say things to them that they thought they would appreciate. Like, the British assumed that the Indians would like to drink the blood of their enemies. And so Ramsey's talking about stuff like that here. He's talking about how the British were enticing the Indians to go against the Americans. And here we got the same verbiage about drinking blood. Yeah, you know, a secret path, narrow passage, a secret way. These are not all unique to Ramsey either. It's just this fine example of what they were talking about back then and the same exact verbiage and usage in the Book of Mormon. And it's clustered heavy in Alma. It's in other places, but I selectively, when I found two in Alma, I would place them next to each other. There may be the same one in another place in the Book of Mormon, but to make a point, I was showing like Alma 56, 58, 56, 23, well, you know, it's all in the same passages, which makes you think that if there's so much over here and there's so much over here, you know, somebody was pulling from it or just was spilling out of somebody's head. Somebody was familiar with the material. I like driving the Americans before them, driving the Nephites before them. Now, Ramsey uses better grammar. He says, alternately drove and were driven by each other. And the poor grammar in the Book of Mormon, they were driven back, but they drove them back. Well, which them, you know? Now, John Marshall had a history. He had five volumes set. So now I'm up to more than 2,000 pages. And I did not bring his... He had some parallels, but interestingly, for five volumes, he outdoes Ramsey and Warren. He has actually less material. So I didn't eliminate him as a source, but it wasn't worth, you know, going through all that. But I did read the five volumes of Marshall's history. Now, here's some other things that start showing up. This is a famous... I got this from my postum table edition of the Family Book of Mormon that my TBM family has. Where this is a proof that in Nephi he says, he made an altar of stones. Now the editor's note says, it may seem easier to refer to the altar of stones as a stone altar. However, the way it is said in this verse is typical of the Hebrew language, which Nephi knew. Well, if Nephi knew it, why was he writing it? You know, why is this in Reformed Egyptian? This is another testimony that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon by the gift of power of God. Well, is that so? Okay. Moving right along. In some of the histories I wrote, and that guy named Thomas Church in 1829, it's a reprint of the History of Phillips War from 16-something, took a nap of sleep. And then John Marshall, his compilation, 1838, is actually material from the prior books, prior to the Book of Mormon. A violent storm of snow? Well, by that logic, are they translating from Hebrew? Is that a Hebraism? You tell me. See, the things that the church says are proofs you can easily undo. I have a technical degree. I have no background in history or language. But it seemed so easy to destroy the Book of Mormon. It didn't take an education to do it. It takes an education to defend it. Where farms will jump through hoops and, you know, try to bring in all these crazy rationales and make it all work. Now, I mentioned the Bible earlier. I'm going to move along to Jonathan Edwards. Now, I'm going to move out of the history of the American Revolution and over into pre-Methodist writings. Because I was finding as I was doing these researches that the founders quoted from the Bible. There's quite a bit of Bible influence throughout the American continent, or the early American continent. Now, Edwards was the most famous, what you would call famous Puritan. He is referred back to by other authorities. And in fact, in my process of research, I went and got this book out about Jonathan Edwards, The Religious Tradition of American Culture. he verifies it here that Edwards is the source. And anytime you read anything Puritan or pre-Methodist, this is where they were getting it from, Jonathan Edwards. He produced over 60,000 pages in his life, and I've not read all 60,000. But Joseph Smith said, I was partial to the Methodists, correct? Now, I mentioned Bible verse and paraphrase, that there's a subtlety that if you automatically assume that any Bible verse or paraphrase in the Book of Mormon came directly from the Bible, that can be refuted. I'll show you why. Hardness of heart, blindness of mind. Now, that's a biblical paraphrase of two different Bible verses. A guy named John Bunyan uses it in 1622. If hardness of heart and blindness of mind so perishing from the way, Edwards, in Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, the most famous sermon of New England, 1741, being given up to hardness of heart and blindness of mind. And look what we got in the Book of Mormon. The same biblical paraphrase. Now, what are the odds of Joseph randomly picking two different Bible verses and coupling them up to come up with the paraphrase? Or is it more likely it came from sources that would have been available to him, namely Methodist adopted Edwardsisms? Now, here's a fun sermon. I kind of searched the internet for as many... And by the way, the internet is like the wall falling for East and West Germany. The reason the wall fell is people on the east side was getting information. It couldn't be stopped. The church is falling because the internet is breaking over that wall and getting information so fast. In this sermon, The Justice of God, I found something very interesting happening. Things you would think were unique in the Book of Mormon when you did not read it in context of the day it was published. The church will say, oh, these are the most beautiful sayings, the most interesting philosophies. Well, look, Book of Mormon says the power of the devil, for he seeks that all men might be miserable like himself. Well, Edwards already said it. So much like the spirit of the devil, who, because he is miserable himself, is unwilling that others should be happy. Now, in this sermon, watch this sequence where Edwards says, how have you neglected your children's souls, and not only so, but have corrupted their minds by your bad examples. Now look at Jacob. You got 2:35, 2:13, 3:12. And lost the confidence of your children because of your bad examples. How much of a spirit of pride has appeared in you, which is a peculiar manner of the spirit and condemnation of the devil. How have some of you vaunted yourselves in your apparel, others in their riches? You have obtained many riches, and because some of you have obtained more abundantly than that of your brother, and you are lifted up in the pride of your hearts and wear stiff necks and high heads because of the costliness of your apparel. And what abominable lasciviousness have some of you been guilty of, how you have indulged yourself from day to day and from night to night in all manner of unclean imaginations. And now I, Jacob, spoke many more things unto the people of Nephi that Edward said, warning them against fornication and lasciviousness and every kind of sin. Now, if you do a word hit in the Book of Mormon, that is the first occurrence of lasciviousness. And it's in the same trickle-down pattern.
We have to agree that Edwards
is
much more eloquent than that.
Thank you, yes. Yes, he is. Well, he tried to scare you into heaven is what was going on. So I found this was a little too close. You know, it's just, the randomness again is getting to the point where this can't be explained the way it's random. Now, his son, this is interesting going on in history. Edwards is teaching people, and then his son later after Edwards dies. There's two camps. You have the Puritans saying, if you sin, you're going, if you don't repent, you're going straight to hell. There is no mitigation of that. There's no short-term punishment. It's all for eternity. Well, his philosophical opponent was a guy named Charles Chauncey, who was a Unitarian Universalist, and he was saying, well, you know, the punishment doesn't quite fit the crime. You'll be punished maybe 1,000 years, blah, 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 but then you'll go on. The same debate goes on in the Book of Mormon where they talk about getting a few stripes on you. You know, the same debate goes on. Well, Edwards Jr. picks up the cross for his dead father in refuting this evil philosophy of Charles Chauncey that you're going to be punished for a short time. So in the counter-argument, these are phrases that this book, it's basically book length, that Edwards Jr. wrote on the subject of universal salvation, 1789. He uses, and I corrected for Bible, these are not Bible phrases, at least on my info base they're not. But I find that over here, you got the same kind of verbiage that's not biblical showing up in the Book of Mormon, that it's unpardonable to sin against the Holy Ghost. It's all there. And the phrases like, that, and he talks about all being finally saved, blah, blah, blah. The same merits of Christ was a good one. I didn't expect that to show up. You know, I don't have to read them all to you. It's just, it's all there. The same kind of things the Puritans were saying are being said in the Book of Mormon, and they're not biblical verses. Now, here's where it gets interesting. On page 248, 247, and in Alma 42. 42 is full of this stuff. Almost every verse in Alma 42 has something that the Edwards are saying. He's trying to make a point. He's saying, look, if you're punished for a short time, you're going to do anything you want because you know you're going to get away with it. If you get a slap on the wrist, you're done. So he's trying to refute that by saying, look, you know, that wouldn't work. He says, it's generally agreed that that murder deserves death, but suppose a law should be made by which no murder should be punished with death, or with any other punishment to be continued longer than till he should repent. Would not such a law as this, compared with the law as it now stands, naturally and directly tend to encourage murder? Now, if there were no law given, if a man murdered, he should die. Would he be afraid he would die if he should murder? It will not be denied that if there were no punishment threatened to the wicked, it would naturally and directly encourage them to persist in vice. And also, if there was no law given against sin, men would not be afraid to sin. Same points being made with the same example.
With horse grammar.
Again, horse grammar. Now, there's another guy by the name of George Whitefield. Now, he was the devotee of the Edwardses. He roamed the American frontier, itinerant preacher from Britain. He was very popular in ways that he probably didn't want to be popular. People came to hear him because they thought he was nuts. He would dance around and scream and yell and cry. But he said he didn't care. As long as they came, he got them there, and that was the important thing. Well, as I'm reading these things, I'm getting links to other things. You know, I'm still going all over the place. Whitefield, let me show you some things he said. He wraps up his sermons. These are three different sermons. He uses certain word strings. He says, God of his infinite mercy, deliver us all through Jesus Christ, to whom with thee, O Father, and thee, O Holy Ghost, three persons and one eternal God be ascribed, as is most due, all honor, power, might, majesty, and dominion, now and forevermore. And he kind of wraps up more or less the same way each time. Well, what do we got in the Book of Mormon? Where he says, it identifies Christ the Son, God the Father, Holy Spirit, as one eternal God. You cannot get that combination in the Bible. That's not resourced in the Bible. Now, the other word string, in his glory, in his might, majesty, power, and dominion, is showing up in the Whitefield sermons published prior to the Book of Mormon. So what are the odds of these word strings in their exact order showing up over there? No. We all know who Jonathan Swift is, right? I should have a prize, but I don't. Does anybody know what Jonathan Swift's, Gulliver's first name is? Who knew that?
What is it?
I would expect Richard Packham would know that. I'll show you.
Lemuel.
Gulliver's Travels.
No way.
Lemuel Gulliver. Now, why is this significant? Having been born of goodly parents, therefore I was taught somewhat in all learning of my father. Everybody learns that, right? Well, what does Lemuel Gulliver say in chapter 6? Having been born of plain, honest parents who were just able to give me a tolerable education. What you thought was unique is no longer unique. Now, an ignominious death, Alma, I think, 1:15. It says where Nehor was carried up to this hill where he was caused to confess or basically was hung. An ignominious death. Mercy Warren uses that phrase. David Ramsey uses that phrase. Jonathan Swift uses that phrase. So, an ignominious death is not unique in the Book of Mormon. By what authority? Now, for people who've been through the temple, if you haven't been there, you're not going to get this. Ramsey, Warren, the commander, surprised in his bed, was called upon to surrender the fort. He asked, by what authority? Colonel Allen replied, I demand it in the name of the great Jehovah. and the Continental Congress. Now, I don't know if he raised his right arm to the square when he did that. He may have. Warren repeats it. On the surprise of Ticonderoga, the commanding officer there inquired by whose authority this was done. Colonel Allen replied, "I demand your surrender in the name of the great Jehovah and of the Continental Congress." Sound familiar? "Satan, I command you to depart." "By what authority?" "In the name of Jesus Christ, our Master."
Amen.
I didn't see anybody get up and leave. How does it feel to be a member of the elect, no longer deceived? This is one of the more fun ones. Peleel, I found you the Hebrews. This is not a complete list, but these what Ethan Smith is doing is he's making anecdotal evidence to support his theory that the Indians are Hebrews. So he has what he calls Indian words, English words, and the Hebrew Chaldaic words. Well, in that list, he's got God as El. To pray as Pele. 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 El. To pray to God in view of the Hebrews. Pele. El. Oh God, hear the words of my mouth. That's, you know, am I looking at clouds, ink blots? I don't know. You tell me. It doesn't bode well for Joseph Smith, does it? Oh, that's it. I'm done.
You have convinced me that Joseph Smith was a clever plagiarizer, but I would be very interested in your speculations as to how he manages to get all of these things into the Book of Mormon. I mean, did he have a photographic memory?
I have a theory.
Just a minute. Did he have notes in the bottom of the hat that he was looking into? And if so...
Glad you reminded me of that.
And if so, what was the source of light in the bottom of the hat? Was it that stone glowing?
I actually have... I'm really not done, but I'm done with that part. But as far as... now we're commentary. Don't anybody ever say to you, "Well, that was the language of the day." Really? What was the official method, especially by Whitmer, one of the witnesses? What did he say happened? Joseph Smith would look in the hat with this magic stone, and he would see a character, and under it the English translation. Joseph Smith is not translating if this is what's going on. It's being dictated to him. This is God quoting men. So now you've got the apologist saying, well, God told them what to say. And God's telling Joseph Smith to say it, and it's all the same. I had I corresponded, like I said, with some unofficial, who don't count, apologists. This one guy, of course, he was a co-author of a book, 1,000 Evidences for the Book of Mormon. And I emailed him, I said, I have 1,000 evidences of borrowing in the Book of Mormon. Well, he kind of chastised me. He sends me a Book of Mormon scripture, and he says, "Tom, you can take any book and find numerous similarities in thought and expression with other books. God reveals the same thoughts and expressions to different people. ESP, and this guy's a published author, ESP is another explanation of similarities in thoughts and expressions between various books." Is this the best he can do? I told him, Bruce R. McConkie would probably not appreciate that. But, you know, if this is the best they can do, that we have nothing to fear. I'm sorry. Oh, the theory on your question. Either he's foolhardy and he doesn't think he'll get caught, which may be the case, or he was not the author and he didn't know. If you look at Solomon Spaulding's writings, you'll find these links on my web pages. I cannot publicly say Spaulding is the author of the Book of Mormon because there's more work to be done. I can say I've got borrows. I will publicly say these are borrows. It's evidence of borrowing which negates the Book of Mormon's authenticity. But Spaulding directly plagiarizes from Mercy Otis Warren. I've got that itemized. He was also a preacher. He would have been familiar with these other writings, too. Now, my theory, based on what you've seen, is Joseph Smith may have had a manuscript. He naively assumes it's original, passes it on as original, not guarding on this stuff. He is the uneducated farm boy. He hadn't read all the books if Spaulding was the author. He has not read all the books Spaulding did. Spaulding was much more educated. Spaulding was a veteran of the American Revolution. Spaulding is not attempting to retell history, or to tell an actual history. He's attempting to retell history. Takes these fictional people, puts them in the past, has them do this little moral melodrama to convey the thoughts, just like we do with science fiction stories today. Put it off in the future, get a proper environment to have a, you know, your theories exposed or expounded on. But like I said, I can't go there. It's circumstantial that there is heavy evidence of Mercy Otis Warren in Spalding's writings and in the Book of Mormon. Yes?
So, Tom, I just think you missed the obvious explanation, is that all the founding fathers were somehow influenced by the Book of Mormon.
I heard that. In fact, to quote the partner of this fellow, the co-author, the guy that thinks ESP is irrational, and he says, by the way, no active faithful LDS person is going to abandon the church as long as reasonable possibilities such as these can be presented to counter objections and accusations by critics. Well, he is murdering reason if ESP is an explanation. His partner wrote me and he said, oh, Tom, your research is excellent, but you've missed the point. It proves the Book of Mormon is true because what God told the founding fathers is the same thing he told the Nephites. But you know what? When they have to hijack and adopt your stuff, you've already won. You've won that battle. There's no need to worry about it after that. They are dancing to your tune. Yes?
Do you plan to publish this, or has it been published?
I was discouraged from publishing early because it would never be published at this point. It would, the web, thanks to Jeff Ricks and MormonStudies.com, I get about 250 hits a month. So I'm getting a word a month by my estimation. And what's very gratifying is when I find people in chat rooms discussing it where I don't know who these people are. It's been like a virus, you know, it's invading the Mord collective.
Give us the website.
I hand out little cards, but it's postmormon.org. You can find it there. /Tories.
And you also link to it from the foundation's website.
Thank you.
All the
yes.
Recordings.
Any other questions?
We also have on the website on the agenda for this conference the link.
Thank you. Thank you, Sue. Yes?
There's two accounts that I know of the description of Joseph Smith revealing. One is with his face in the hat. The other one is he's behind the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if he was deceiving people, it's very likely that the people who give the account could have stuck his face in the hat or his companions. I mean, why do you think on one hand Joseph Smith was deceiving people, but his close buddies that were working with him weren't in on it with him?
We don't know.
So therefore, I'm suggesting that the story of him sticking his face in the hat could be a fabrication itself.
Or he had a memory where he could pull up all this stuff and throw it all together.
I see him in a room with these books and flipping through them and just thinking, well, okay, I'll take this here and I'll take that there and just work on it. Like if you were doing that history report with the Book of Encyclopedia, you'd be sitting there with the books and the different pages.
Certainly.
I can see him doing that.
Yeah. Well, you know, you see the themes occurring. You got the Kingmen, you got Moroni, Washington, all the problems they have. Moroni, what's his problem? He's trying to fight the Lamanites, who are trying to take away his freedom. And he's got the Kingmen inside, working away inside, trying to destroy the more Republican-style government and go for a king to rule the land. You know, it just gets to the point where this is a duplication of the themes. Yes?
I just had a revelation.
Yeah, oh, great.
You have a hat?
That's why the Book
of
Mormon in the box is so heavy. It was all these volumes.
That's why my briefcase is so heavy.
Do you have any thoughts on the theory that Sidney Rigdon had anything to do with...
Rigdon was in Pittsburgh. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and he's in Pittsburgh, and Spalding tried to get his manuscript published in Pittsburgh. That's the circumstantial evidence.
So, but do you think he had more to do with the rewriting?
You know, we don't know if it's fully original, been doctored, you know, pieced apart, put back together again. Yes?
Can you comment on whether Joseph Smith had the ability to read these books, whether he had access...
That's why I'm thinking he was working from a manuscript of some kind.
Whether he had access to them and whether he had time to do it.
Yeah.
The Mormon was published when he was 22, 23 years old.
Right. That's why I say I can't publicly stand here and say, Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon and this is where he got the material from. All I can say is this material exists. It got there somehow. And it would more reasonably be explained that he might have been working from some other manuscript that had all this stuff in it. He didn't have to come up with all of it. And that's why he passed it along, not knowing he was passing along borrowings. And that's how they show up later.
Let's not forget, too, that he was the ultimate con man.
Right. Yes.
Charismatic, lived off of other people almost his entire life, engaged Martin Harris and Oliver Cowdery and whoever else he knows to give him money, assist him. And when you say he didn't have time to do this, he did have time to do this because he was always living in someone else's house, living off of someone else's money.
Yes, in the
and
back there.
He was a gifted storyteller.
Of course.
Yeah, well, I kind of had this little theory. I kind of wanted to hear what you thought about it. I always thought that the whole translation thing was just a scam in order to get Martin Harris.
Cough up the dough, sure.
Right. Yeah. So when I read that story about Sidney Rigdon describing, you know, Joseph Smith putting his head in the hat, and reading the paper, I looked at that as, well, maybe he's got this manuscript back there, and he's taking them one page at a time,
right,
putting them in the hat, and he just starts reading what he sees on the page, all for the benefit of scamming, you know, getting Martin Harris to buy into it.
Right.
When he's done with that page, he goes and gets the next page.
It's all magic, isn't it? Jeff. Yes.
Yeah, I kind of like the combination of Sue's and your theory there. I think he was probably working from a manuscript that somebody else prepared or a group prepared. And they possibly sought Joseph Smith out to help him find their education. I think it's a genius con. And they may have said, you know, you're the front man on this.
But, go ahead.
I have to comment. We have to remember the original condition of the first Book of Mormon, the awful grammar and the hideous, you know, of the massive number of repairs, the lack of punctuation. I doubt that he had a page written by anyone intelligent to look at. However, if any of you flip the dial and you watch evangelical Christian speakers, immediately you know these people are not very intelligent. And don't they just string these resounding phrases together in just kind of a hodgepodge? Like they threw them all up in the air and they fell down again.
That's exactly what these preachers, Edwards Jr., Whitefield, they're all doing it. In fact, you got to be careful. They're throwing out so much Bible paraphrase because they know it. You may not. You may think what they're saying is their words, and it's not.
And he was in an era where they were having the landscape was absolutely littered with camp-town preachers. All
absolutely.
And many of them with ancient Indian stories. So the Book of Mormon does not have a very convoluted, well-put-together plot. All of that was kind of massaged later.
Yeah, we can discuss as much as we want as long as Sue says so.
Are you done with what you
I'll want? Go as long as you want. Yeah, the body of the presentation's done.
Okay.
Yes.
We can go to 11:30.
Okay, go there and then there.
I just wondered in your study if you did any, in reading Mr. Adams' book, The Chief Stone of Mormon.
No. No. Oh, yes, Arza? Yes, yes, I read it.
Sorry. He mentioned in there about, you know, view of the Hebrews, Ethan Smith, and how the general plot of civilizations rising and falling, and that.
Well, let me tell you about Mercy Otis Warren. Mercy Otis Warren accurately prophesied, if you want to call her a prophet. She was very much ahead of her time. She prophesied that the Indians would be hunted. She uses the words hunted from the continent. And what does Moroni lament? That his people will be hunted out of existence. And she saw that occurring. She knew as long as white men would keep coming into the land, the Indians would be pushed off and exterminated. She also, as a Christian woman, in her let me read a quote from her. I can't find it right. She considered the current generation she was writing to, I'll find this here, as a degenerate, servile race of beings. She's writing this history, and it published in 1805. She sees exactly the same theme the Book of Mormon presents. People are oppressed. They remember God. They start obeying God. They get prosperity. They start getting prosperity. They forget God. They have their rights removed from them. Their freedoms go away because their enemies conquer. She is sermonizing in her history. She sees this occurring. She's trying to stop it from occurring. And I believe that whoever wrote the Book of Mormon saw that theme that same theme, and she was already writing about that theme. Yeah, it's no different. There was a... Go ahead.
Yeah, it's an observation. I don't think anyone's ever thought about this, but thinking about the power of the imagery of the Bible and how the last 250 years since the Puritans left Europe, how American politics has really taken a hold of that image, powerful imagery that all everybody who resounds, you know, responds to as American, even through the last election.
Bush used the phrase blessings of liberty. I heard him say that in a speech.
I've read a lot of political commentaries that talk about how the Bush administration became the masters of really manipulating their base using a lot of the same vivid imagery that goes back 250 years.
Good observation. Yes?
Yeah, one comment about the idea of working from a manuscript or not. Is that they lost their first...
Yeah, Martin Harris's wife was pretty smart.
And then he was pretty pissed, and that was lost. And so then he had to rewrite it, but differently and starting differently. And there's one of the doctors in governance where he's really angry because that didn't
happen. Yeah, well, he had to write it different because the other people would change it to prove him wrong, see?
Exactly. So, I don't know, to me that
And I don't know. I can't stand up there and say I know. All I can say is, you saw the evidence. You know, there's no way out of the exact verbiage being there when this is a dictation from an ancient record. There was a yes. Go ahead. I've heard of that. I tended to stay away from things I've seen. I did not want to go over old ground that other people have done. There's plenty of good work on chiasmus. As far as I'm concerned, Dr. Seuss has chiasmus. That's not an issue. So I did not go to places where other people have done work, but if you Google it, you'll get it. It's out there.
Well, if you're talking about word streams, and the Tree of Life vision is what, maybe 300 or 400 words. And, I mean, for those that don't know, Joseph Smith Sr., Joseph's father, had several visions years earlier, at least 10 years before the Book of Mormon was written, which Lucy Mack, his mother, supposedly transcribed almost verbatim. And one of them is the Tree of Life vision. And the one in the vision, the version in the Book of Mormon is almost word for word identical for 300 or 400 words.
Mm-hmm. I've read that account of his his grandfather's vision of his own truth. Maybe it was a spot, excuse me. Yeah, I read that. But anything that I had read that I had already seen before, I kind of just, that's fine. I moved along to something that hasn't been approached. Go ahead.
Have you done any comparison with the Apocrypha?
No. I do this at night, under cover of darkness, and I'm going through literally, dozens of books this thick to get to this point, to call out this material. There was a lot of material that didn't work, like I said about... Marshall, the significant thing I saw was he would use the phrase storm of snow instead of snowstorm. That makes him Hebrew too. Go ahead.
Just did a comment about how when you have found another book, the John Book Mormon helps prove how inspired by God. I mean, God created the entire universe. He should get more original.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer that God has to borrow from men, He's relying on men now to come up with verbiage.
Yes. Just a comment. It seems to me that, curiously, the very familiarity of the terms and the familiarity of the ideas may have made people more comfortable with the Book of Mormon and made it more credible for them.
I wonder if that's why he was pilloried as much as he was, because people saw it and they didn't even need to explain it. Oh, wow, we've seen all this before. This is a bunch of baloney. Now, I did correspond with Richard L. Bushman. And he is the closest one you could get to that would have an explanation, because he's, I guess, an American history professor and he's an apologist. We emailed or corresponded briefly. His final letter to me, he says this: I can imagine how startled you were to find such striking similarities in the writings of George Washington and the text of the Book of Mormon. Then he goes on to say how I'm an amateur and it didn't bother him any. But if he likes to write supporting books on the Book of Mormon. And he's an American history professor. I don't know that for sure, but I think he is. If he is, why has he not used this in a faith-promoting talk or book? I have told these other fellows, the one that believes ESP is a rational explanation, I said, feel free to use my stuff in your next sacrament meeting talk. Beware, though, the bishop may tap you on the shoulder because a bunch of people may not get what your point, which is this is proving the Book of Mormon. They may be going, wait a minute. So if my stuff is so brilliant, why don't they just adopt it and have a fireside on it, proving how wonderful the Book of Mormon is.
I guess for me, the size of this lie is so huge, it's inconceivable to me that a man can lie that way.
If you have no conscience.
But to honest people, you can't believe that anyone can lie.
Get a book called The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. That will explain everything on that regard. Rational people don't want to believe that people are doing this. And that stops us from going to where we should go and say, he is. He really is. He is doing that. We don't want
to
believe it.
The only other thing that comes to mind is that you can't con an honest.
Thank you. Yes?
It may be true that Joseph Smith had no idea just how far his huge life would go.
Yeah, once you start telling them, you got to keep doing it, don't you? You can't backtrack.
And it's gone generation after generation, so it's compounded on itself.
Yeah. Go ahead, Arza.
Hitler's propaganda ministry says that people have no defense for a big lie. You don't know how to handle a big lie.
Go ahead.
Well, something just occurred to me, and I may be way off base here, and I wanted to ask you if it had occurred to you during this process. For instance, the gentleman brought up Goebbels, which is an interesting sidebar. There are some words in German. The German has some similarities to our language, but there are some words that are not translatable.
Not translatable, correct.
Unless you know the concept involved in the word. I just wordered if you were... I was looking at the word stream. You have English word streams on the left from an author. You have the Book of Mormon word stream on the right, and they're very similar. But when you have an ancient Hebrew who is translating his concepts into this ostensibly reformed Egyptian, you have all these different concepts.
I'll let them twist in the wind on that one.
Word streams themselves.
Yeah, you just got to go back to Peter Whitmer, one of the most credible witnesses of the Book of Mormon translation, where he says the character appeared in the hat on the stone and the English word below it. So there's whatever interpretation is coming out is directly pipelined from God through that stone. There is no interpretation going on. Joseph Smith is not translating into the word of the day. You now have to say God is giving Joseph Smith these things through that stone. So don't... Yeah, I've heard it so many times. What's the language of the day? Really? Go ahead.
Check other writings of Joseph Smith to see if these things were also in the...
Well, in the Doctrine and Covenants, in the dedicatory prayer of the Kirtland Temple, George Whitefield had a book of sermons published in 1820. He was dead by now, but they were funeral sermons. And in this, these sermons, they were taken down shorthand by a stenographer. He's talking about a woman that's dying that he was preaching to. She's now dead. And so Whitefield says, and she looked up, and I'm going to paraphrase, she looked up to heavens and said, crowns, crowns, crowns of glory shall be upon my head, and with palms, palms, palms in my hand, I shall see Christ again. And what does Joseph Smith say in the dedicatory prayer at the Kirtland Temple? With palms in our hands and with crowns of glory upon our heads. And then in that very same Doctrine and Covenants section, he uses the word string, honor, glory, power, might, majesty, dominion. Whitefield uses that exact word string. What are the odds of Whitefield having used those combinations of words in those orders and having it show up in a revelation? The Doctrine and Covenants says that the dedicatory prayer was revealed to Joseph Smith. But it's got George Whitefield in it. Well, Whitefield was inspired. Even if he believed children that didn't die with baptism go, even if he believed that children who died without baptism would burn in hell, we can eliminate, that's okay, he was wrong there, but he was right over here. See, God inspired Whitefield to say those things, and he was right then. And when Joseph Smith said it, that's okay too. You know, that's what you get. Did I answer your question? I'm sorry. Okay. Are we done, sir?
Now you got one more question.
There it is.
Hiram went to school in New Hampshire, didn't he?
I don't know. I know that Hiram was the worshipful master of the Nauvoo Lodge of the Masonic Order. And that's in church history. I read the seven volumes, whatever it is, the seven volumes with the index of the church, history of the church. And there's notes in there that Hiram Smith, worshipful master of the Nauvoo Lodge, led the parade down Main Street. What is a worshipful master? Well, he's the dude that brings other devotees into the Masonic Lodge by recommend. Who do you bring in? His brother.
Thank you.
Fascinating. When I first, when he first sent me his material, when we were discussing whether he would be able to come and do this, and when I read through it and saw it, I just thought it was absolutely fascinating. Because I've always been a real student of history, and to see all that, you know, some of which I remember studying in high school and college, and then to see the similarities is just really fascinating to me. One short announcement: there is a small subgroup that has an internet group, and it's called, they've asked me to call it the Randall Group, is that what you told me? It's going to be meeting by the piano in the atrium as soon as we dismiss, and I think those I'm addressing know who they are. But that's where you'll be meeting, is by the piano in the atrium. Now, we need to be back here and ready to go at 1 o'clock, and there is a restaurant in the hotel, and we've got enough time. There's probably, somebody said there was a McDonald's close, I don't know where that is, but if anybody can stomach it. Anyway, I'll see you back at 1. Thank you.